So you don't ask the person over the fence how to fix your heart attack. You don't ask your neighbor, I've got this lump on my kidney, what am I going to do about that? But everyone will give you an opinion about sleep.
Today's episode of the podcast, number 2 in the series on sleep, I speak with David Cunnington. David is a specialist sleep physician, and today he discusses with me the strange cultural hang-ups we have about sleep, such as it being associated with weakness, when in reality it is one of the ultimate pillars to physical and mental well-being. We also discuss some of the research and methods behind a good night's sleep, as well as the lingering myths purported by wellness sites or bloggers, and how we can circumvent these as a population. If you would like to learn more about what David had to say, he has his own podcast named Sleep Hope. He also has an operating clinic in Melbourne, as well as a bunch of other resources that can be found at drdavidcunnington.com.au.
Mind-bending chemicals.
I don't care. He wants to kill me.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
And it's an interesting point that you make. It makes sleep and practicing in sleep different to other areas of medicine. So you don't ask the person over the fence how to fix your heart attack, or you don't ask your neighbor, I've got this lump on my kidney, what am I going to do about that? But everyone will give you an opinion about sleep, and partly because it's just a universal human experience. We all have a lot of our own lived experience about sleep. Sleep's been largely seen of as outside the medical space. So a lot of even what health professionals will tell people about sleep is more based on societal beliefs, cultural beliefs, myths, history, those type of things, rather than science. And that's one of my challenges when I'm talking to health professionals or educating health professionals around sleep, is how much of the advice you're giving to patients is based on your own belief system versus something you've actually learnt as part of a scientific finding about sleep. And often I'll reflect on that and go, oh yeah, in actual fact, it's more belief stuff. I think this is good for sleep, and therefore that's what I've been telling my patients. So yeah, how do we contend with that? So interestingly, it means in some respects it makes my job a bit easier, because a lot of the work that I'm doing in sleep is debunking myths. So rather than necessarily having to get really high tech and really sort of detailed with people, sometimes it's just recalibrating expectations around sleep to a more realistic expectation based on the sort of scientific understanding of sleep and the biology of sleep, rather than the, I think it should be this because this is what I've always been brought up to believe it should be like. So it means a lot of the work I do is psychoeducation, and that's partly why, even though I'm a medical specialist and I write in medical journals, I also run a website about sleep and run a podcast and write a blog and participate in social media, because that's trying to get out some of those sort of debunking some of the myths about sleep and getting out some of that different understanding about sleep.
And that's interesting that you were saying that actually, not necessarily the problem is the people you're treating. It's actually the carers and the healthcare workers themselves, which is something I hadn't really considered. But I suppose that's a testament to how anecdotal it really is, because even those that we're sort of trusting to bring the care, it's also difficult as well. And how much danger is there, I suppose, of there being the encroachment of, I guess, these myths or pseudoscience within the sphere of sleep?
A lot. And we see that particularly in the way popular media works in this day and age. Popular media is about clicks and eyeballs and attention. So a lot of the writing about sleep, and sleep articles are very popular because you're right, affects everybody, right, has an impact on day-to-day functioning. People are sort of cognizant of trying to want to help their sleep. So a lot of the articles about sleep have got to be the, right, here's the 5 ways to fix your sleep tonight.
Yes.
And if only you knew that eating 2 bananas would give you perfect sleep, you would have been eating 2 bananas every night for your entire life. So there's a whole lot of sort of misinformation, or, there might be one small case report published in a poor quality scientific journal, but that's the thing, beauty. Now you've got a freelance writer
that
can say,
right,
this thing is published. It says that you eat 2 kiwi fruit, you're going to sleep perfectly, and then you get the clickbait article that really goes well. And so it is trying to counter that. I don't write for HuffPost anymore, but I used to write blogs for HuffPost about sleep. Mm-hmm. And I'd, in parallel with that, I'd be writing sort of what I thought was nice evidence-based balanced articles about sleep, but a whole lot of the other writers for HuffPost that are more in the wellness space would be churning out the listicle articles about sleep is, if only you did my exercise routine or my meditation routine or you ate my supplement or you did my thing, your sleep would be perfect. So it's hard to try to counter that sort of messaging. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the challenges with communication around sleep, you know, communication around science in general in this day and age, is how do you differentiate sort of well-curated, balanced information from not well-curated, balanced information? Mm-hmm. And that's really tough. You know, it used to be in medicine, you know, 30, 40 years ago, we would be the curators of the knowledge, and you could almost, you would disclose or tell to the patient, right, this is what I think is relevant for you. We no longer hold the knowledge. The knowledge is in the public realm, and that's fantastic that people can access, you know, the scientific knowledge. But people need to, you know, have the skills of critical appraisal, mm-hmm, of being able to work out what's good information versus what's information I'm going to, you know, take with a grain of salt. So I see my role when I'm talking to people is some of that. It's critical appraisal. It's going, you know what, there's all this stuff out there in the literature, both in the scientific literature and the lay literature. Mm-hmm. The bits that are relevant for you are this, this, and this. And you've read this, but methodologically that was a little flawed. So you've right. just got to understand that side. Whereas this other study that you hadn't looked at so much, a bit more methodologically valid and a bit more relevant to you. So go off and have a look at that and sort of think about that side of things. So I see my role has really shifted. You know, I've been practicing as a doctor for about 30 years for much more about helping people understand scientific information and how to critically appraise that or work out what's good and bad information to be able to sort of balance that. But it's hard when there's just so many channels of information right. coming at us from all different directions.
Yeah, I mean, I guess that goes back to a little bit to what I mentioned before, is just how much of a huge factor general scientific literacy is. You know, with a higher amount of general scientific literacy, you could probably cut out the bottom 20% of maybe some of these articles that get popular. And I don't really expect you to list all of them that you come across, because I'm sure there's an innumerable amount. But is there any sort of things that particularly gets your goat or annoys you that you see pop up again and again and again that is completely against what is actually true?
We need 8 hours sleep.
Really?
Yep.
Why is that?
Because we don't.
Okay.
So that's a short answer. So if you know, across a population, mm-hmm, you think of it as roughly the mean across a population sleep per night, it's going to be 8-ish hours, mm-hmm, per night. But like any normal distribution of data, that's the mean. And then there's tails either side of that. Mm-hmm. So that there are people that are very healthy that sleep shorter than 8 hours, and people that are very healthy that sleep longer than 8 hours. And if you think about what determines how long we sleep, it's a function of, in our brain, when we're awake, the enzymes, our particular enzymes, which are coded by our own particular genes, they create some waste products and products that actually drive sleep. And then when we're asleep, other enzymes break down those waste products. And again, they're genetically coded. So if you get, okay, we're all genetically different, I'm a bit shorter and don't have as much hair as I wish I had. And some people aren't going to sleep as long as they wish they could, or sleep longer than they wish they did, just because of our genes. And so recognizing there's a spread across the population. But then you look at the social side of it. So that's just the straight science. The social side is with industrialization in the early 19th century in England, and sort of investment of capital in mills and those type of things. That was when we got the 16 hours of wake, 8 hours of sleep. And this allocation of time in a day was, you know, 8 hours work, 8 hours rest, 8 hours sleep. Whereas up until that, human beings had never been expected to sleep continuously for 8 hours right. or for 8 hours at all. It was really just a guy that was setting up his factory saying, you know what, I need my workers for this many hours per day, and the labor movement saying, well, we need this many hours off, and that means there's 8 hours left, and that's what we're going to say is the sleep time. And so in Western countries, we're very much 200 years into this industrialization of 16 hours of wake. I should have 16 hours of sustained, even 100% on performance. Mm-hmm. And then machine-like, I should switch off and have 8 hours of 100% off, where I know nothing and time just passes. Mm. But that's not biological. There's no other biological systems work like that. But it's how we think about sleep, because we have these social beliefs and cultural beliefs around sleep. Mm-hmm. So that's part of the psychoeducation I do, is often getting people to understand about sleep that there's not just that Western industrial way of thinking about the allocation of time mm-hmm. and allocation of wake and sleep across 24 hours. If you think of pre-industrial societies or developing countries, there's still that fluidity of right. that boundary between wake and sleep. Within my waking period, there can be downtime and periods of rest. Mm. In the same way as during my sleep period, there will be periods when I'm awake and I come up to the surface, because that's actually what happens biologically.
Right.
It's just we've been conditioned in Western societies to compartmentalize these things. Mm. And, you know, in my parents' generation, we was okay to expect to just cruise along at about 80% of performance every day and have good days and bad days. 2020, no one's cruising at 80% performance. Everyone's trying to max out
on the
performance.
Red. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, if my eyes are open, I need to be at 100% performance.
Right. Right.
The only time I'm not 100% performance is when my eyes are closed and I'm sleeping.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting that even in like sort of what you were mentioning, even just in one generation's difference, it's really, really things have changed. And I think it's really speaks to how much of a cultural influence how much influence culture has on sleep. And one of the things that certainly frustrates me the most, and I'm sure frustrates you much, much more, is there is a certain cultural aversion to sleep in this weird thing where sleep is somehow weakness, how the tougher ones sleep 4 hours a night and are getting after it and working at all other hours, when I'm sure in reality there's a whole host of things in ways that that's actually putting them back. So I suppose, why do you think that there is this association with sleep and weakness, when in reality that probably isn't the case?
Right. And absolutely, you know, it's there. But it goes back a long way, in the same way as we can trace this industrialization back to that sort of 8 hours of sleep. If you look back about 500 years ago to some of the puritanical writings from Europe and from England, you know, there's all those sayings, the early bird gets the worm, an hour of sleep before midnight's worth 2 hours after midnight. You know, they're these associating sort of being virtuous with getting up early and with being asleep early. Mm. You know, it's just these, you know, it's putting values on things to do with sleep. And then you sort of fast forward to the establishment of the sort of modern American society, which has that puritanical sort of base, you know, the New Englanders that sort of came from that puritanical background. And very early in US society is that sort of, it's called the cult of manly wakefulness. You know, that real association.
What a title.
Right. So there's actually a book, anthropological book about it, and that's the title of the book. And for me, that just sums it up.
Right.
Because
really
it is just a really, really a way of thinking about East Coast US sort of ways, even today, of thinking about work and life and stuff. It's that cult of manly wakefulness. Mm. It's the bravado of the, you know, while other people are sleeping, I'm working, I'm getting ahead of the others. And you see that reflected not just now in the US, but, you know, Japan, Korea,
yes.
you know, countries that absolutely have that, you know, the Japanese, I can't remember the term for it, but it's the working man is the sort of term.
The salary man, yeah, yeah.
The salary man, that's it.
Yeah.
You absolutely work. From the minute your eyes are open, you are working until you collapse at the end of the day.
Yeah, it's almost certainly a depressing reflection, and I've definitely been guilty of it. I think I've changed my ways over time, but I've definitely been guilty of it myself. I suppose I guess if you have certain people you look up to or mentors, and they have that sort of thing, and famously, Margaret Thatcher was one of those. I remember even sort of my parents' generation when they were talking about how Margaret Thatcher would speak about that. I think Winston Churchill even did the same thing. It's very historically entrenched, isn't it?
It is, but the bit you don't hear, so you get this positive trait
right.
sort of characteristics. People like to align themselves with that positive trait. Mm. But the bit you don't hear is that Margaret Thatcher used to be able to nap in the back, in the car between meetings,
right.
and was a famous for napping. Mm-hmm. But that's in her private space.
Right.
And no, which politician can you remember bragging about, you know what, I'm a great napper. I'm sleeping all over the place.
It's not going to happen.
Right. And so our own sort of prime minister from some years ago, John Howard, you know, all the images you had of John and wherever he was in the world was in his tracksuit out walking
right.
in the morning. That, you know, I'm up early in the morning. I'm, you know, I'm going.
Look
this is
me.
My... This is my thing. And then Julia Gillard came in her first speech, she talked about she wanted to make Australia a place for people who get up early in the morning and get their kids ready for school and get their kids to school on time. Like assigning, you know, what she wanted Australia to represent to this belief about getting up early has been good. You know, and I think of it from a scientific point of view. Right. If you can get up early, it just means your genes, means you've got an internal... body
allow
clock's
you.
A bit shorter than somebody else, allow you to. And so for me, I hear a politician say that and it's like, it's almost like I'm going to systematically discriminate against people who have a particular gene type, that is late night gene type. I'm going to systematically discriminate against them because we don't believe they're as virtuous as those who get up early. But culturally, no one thinks about it like that. Everyone's on board. Great. We, you know, getting up early is good. You know, we're the sort of good, positive people. So, you know, it is, and, you know, sleep's important for mental function. So the other thing we see with politicians is you see them all bragging about we're up late debating such and such a bill, see how hard we are working for you, you know, we're doing all of these things. It's good data on sleep deprivation and decision making showing it's all bad. You're sleep deprived, you make bad decisions. Mm-hmm. And so, again, I hear these stories about politicians debating a bill till 2 a.m. I'm saying, are you really trying to tell me that in public you put yourself in an impaired state
right.
and then you made an important decision about billions of dollars? Seriously? But the fact that the public sees that as a positive trait, because that's what the politicians are sort of telling you they're doing, so they know it polls positively, just tells you where society sits in their attitudes towards sleep.
Stuff like this interests me so much when you can really pinpoint sort of this divide between what we think and what is actually true. And this happens, of course, in many different facets of medicine, many different facets of different areas of science in general. So I guess something that would be good to talk about was the fact that general health is incredibly complex. You know, I mentioned it before. It's not like physics. It's not like it's certainly not binary, right? There are many factors that contribute to many different things. So I think everyone has heard about the benefits of sleep and sort of, should we say, long-term health, things like heart disease, things like, you know, dementia in the future. I think most of the population, I should hope, has had some sort of grasp on that. But the reality of sleep, from my knowledge, is it's incredibly broad and sort of gets its fingers into just about every area of functioning, be it health, be it productivity in terms of physical or even studying, be it just about everything we can do. So can you give us an idea of sort of how broad the ramifications of incorrect sleep, shall we say, actually has?
Right. So I'll come back to that. You're right. Mm-hmm. It is incredibly broad. But just before I start on that, you flip it the other way as well. So the other way of thinking about it is sleep is a barometer of physical and mental health. Mm-hmm. So if sleep is off, it's not necessarily that sleep has caused the negative consequence. It may be that the sleep being off is a marker that there's something else not right. Now, it's that relationship which then skews a lot of this observational data, because you're right, there's lots of long-term observational studies where, you know, you may look at the study design, maybe something like looking at people that are short sleepers and what are the long-term health outcomes of people with short sleep, or long sleepers and the long-term health outcomes. And it shows that there are negative effects associated with both long and short sleeping. Cardiovascular effects, so hypertension, heart disease, cognitive effects, so depression, anxiety, other cognitive effects like Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative disorders. But is it the disorder and an early marker of the disorder? Is that sleep changes as a downstream product of an internal regulatory process that's right. beginning to not work well? And so then in your sort of long-term research, the bit you're asking is the measurement is, did sleep change? And then your outcome variable is what else changed? And it may just be that there's an association between those two things rather than it being causal.
Right.
Because we see that in the insomnia literature, where if you look at people that sleep short, and this is there's another one of these sort of clickbait articles that really sort of go well in the popular media, is all the bad things that'll happen to you if you don't sleep well. You know, they're very popular mm-hmm. articles because mm-hmm. they catastrophize and incite mm-hmm. fear and that type of thing. But they're all based on taking people that are thought to be normal, so a general population, looking at this clumping of who's sleeping short, and if we follow them over time, what happens? Now, that incorporates people who both choose to sleep short, so, you know, work when you're dead. I'm going to voluntarily sleep deprive myself. It includes people who sleep short for other medical and health reasons. They got pain, they got depression, they got anxiety that get in the way of sleep. It includes people who wish they could sleep more but can't, and that's the involuntary sleep deprivation that is insomnia. You're sort of wishing for more sleep.
Right.
And so it doesn't stratify those different groups, and very different things are happening in each of those different groups.
Right.
And so when I see the small subset of people who've got insomnia, you know, let's say 1 in 6 adults who've got insomnia, and they say, look, I've got insomnia, I'm sleeping short, that means I'm going to get Alzheimer's. I'm like, well, that research connection has not actually been established. It's been established that healthy people who tend to sleep short have a higher rate of Alzheimer's in the future, but it may actually be that the sleeping short up front was an early sign, a canary in the coal mine
right.
for Alzheimer's, not the cause.
All the way around, okay.
Yeah. I mean, there's a number of examples of that. We see a thing called REM behavior disorder, where people act out dreams, is a very early sign of Parkinson's disease and some of the forms of dementia that are like Parkinson's. And it's actually a sign that people can get many years before they actually develop Parkinson's and many years before other symptoms have been found of Parkinson's. Now, it doesn't mean it causes Parkinson's. Mm. It's just that the sleep changes. It's sleep is the barometer for physical and mental health. Sleep's the canary in the coal mine of anything else going on in the body. And the sleep's the first thing that shifts and then just gives the clue that, there may be something else going on. So that's often my challenge for people is, you know, don't necessarily see the sleep as the cause. You know, there's all these bad things going on in my life, and if only I could fix sleep, that would fix them all.
Right.
It may actually be that the sleep is just a marker that there are bad things going on in life, and maybe that's got to be the target for things.
Somewhere between the sort of chicken and the egg argument and somewhere between the correlation and causation, right? It's a mixture of all of those factors going on. And I guess before we go back to the original point, I will just quickly ask, how do you keep that in mind during treatment? This is obviously a very complex question. There's more than one answer. But for example, someone with insomnia, how do you tackle it when you have two things in mind, right? There's one thing in mind that there's something genetically or something, maybe some other disorder that's occurring, which is meaning that they cannot get the sufficient sleep that they're sort of desiring. But on the flip side to that, there's all of these internal pressures, there's all of these maybe bad habits that these people have in a modern society, et cetera, which is making them, I suppose, having less sleep. So how do you sort of get through that smog and find the reality of what's happening?
Yeah, really, really good question. And it's thinking of it as layers and trying to peel back layers and see what happens. So one of the first things is, tidying up some of the lifestyle factors and seeing, does that help? Now, in my role as a specialist sleep physician, most of the time people have done that before they come and see me.
Great.
So before you come and see a medical specialist, you're going to go, you know what, I better go and make sure I'm doing the right thing before I sort of take the time to come and see a medical specialist. And so usually I'm seeing people who've tidied up those lifestyle things, but still feel that sleep isn't working well. So then that at least is one layer that's been peeled back from my point of view.
Mm-hmm.
at a very simplistic level, I'm trying to look then at someone's overall physical and mental health, their lifestyle, and thinking, is the sleep what I would expect as an expected consequence of that? You know, so I'll give you an example, you know, seeing, it's not uncommon actually in the last 6 months, you know, seeing people with major financial or social stresses,
right,
you know, for a whole range of different reasons during the pandemic. And, you know, someone will tell me, well, I find it hard to get to sleep. I'm waking frequently during the night. I'm sleeping shorter than I have historically. I get night sweats. I'm getting vivid dreams. They're all symptoms of heightened adrenaline drive. You know, if we're in a heightened adrenaline drive state, we're not going to get to sleep as readily. We're going to wake more during the night. We're going to run a bit hotter during the night. We're going to have a bit more motor restlessness. We're going to have a bit more dream recollection. So that's just situationally appropriate sleep for the circumstances that someone's in. And so to then say, well, we'll patch over that. We'll just fix your sleep up. Well, sleep's not even the problem. It's just the marker of things. And really the pathway for them in terms of getting better is recognizing there's a whole lot of stuff going down. And the brain is in this heightened adrenaline sort of state. So I've got to work with that, try and do the best I can to mitigate that and recognize the sleep will follow that. And if that settles, the sleep will also improve.
Right.
And so that's one way of trying to work out, is the sleep situationally appropriate for the bigger context of what's going on. And so when I think there's a independent sleep disorder is when it's not situationally appropriate. So that there's not a whole lot of other stuff going on, but in actual fact, they've still got symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'm like, okay, well, what's going on with sleep itself that we then need to address?
All right, so we've contended with the rearrangement of our thoughts, that it's not necessarily a lack of sleep makes you sick in the future. It could also be the opposite of that. And we've also contended with, I guess, a few of the steps of how you make a diagnosis or how you actually think about a patient that might be coming in. But back to the point that we were mentioning before, what is the reason for trying to fix these sleep disorders? What are the feelings, the feelers of sleep? What does it actually affect, and why does it matter for us? Again, a massive question that we're trying to fit into a 40-minute period. But
the hard thing is we don't really know.
Right.
So short of that overarching sort of statement of, okay, what's the purpose of sleep? Sleep is a restorative process that we cannot function without. Right, so that's pretty certain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of examples of that. Voluntary sleep deprivation studies showing that there's lots of consequences. People become unwell, reduced immunity, blood pressure problems, the cognitive problems, you know, all manner of different things if people don't sleep enough. But beyond that, we actually don't really know what all these processes are in a biological sense, and how much do we need of this type of stage of sleep? And is it, because people tell me that every day, oh, it's the REM sleep I need, I'm not getting enough of that, or it's the deep sleep I'm not getting enough of, or I need more of this. And I was like, I'm glad you know what the problem is, because be blown if I know in terms of really understanding how that loss of one stage of sleep translates to changes in human health and human performance, because it's far less certain than what we really know. It's one of the great sort of doyens in sleep research, a guy called Bill Dement from Stanford. And he used to say, well, you know, why do we go to sleep? People would ask him. It was so we don't bump into things in the dark. And, you know, it's almost like we're not that much more sophisticated than that in terms of our understanding of things, except that it's an essential process. And we know what happens if we don't get it. But that's a different question, you know, well, how much do we need, and what characteristics does it have to have, and what's it got to feel like, and what function does it need to provide? You know, it's, we don't really know. And the other important thing I'm often trying to calibrate people with is sleep is not the only restorative function as humans. So we learn a lot of this from the athletic literature. So athletes recognize if they train hard, they must have a period of recovery. And sure, they need to sleep too, but there's also got to be recovery. When we don't do that physical work, so if we're doing cognitive work, which is for a lot of people now in sort of 21st century, we don't have that same thing about we have to have recovery.
Interesting.
We really see we have cognitive work and then we have sleep. Whereas an athlete or someone who does physical things, recognizing I can only do so much physical work, and then I need to have rest. And in addition, I need to have sleep. And so that's where I think, you know, in a lot of the time people say I'm exhausted during the day, I can't focus, I'm having trouble with memory and concentration and these type of things. But there's no rest recovery. And feed up time, self-care, nurturing activities, things that we don't put in the spending energy sort of part of the ledger during the day are often few and far between. And people then are exhausted. The thing they can measure, the tangible thing they can put their finger on is, well, I woke up three times last night and I only slept for, my Fitbit said I slept for 6 hours instead of seven. Like, well, that's why I'm not functioning well. Yeah, well, where's the recovery? Where's the time off task? You know, where's the rest in the way an athlete or someone who did physical work would have those things as part of their day? But as cognitive workers, that seems to have gone by the wayside.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, I do hope, and I sort of, I'm slightly getting the feeling that the way that the movement with, I guess, a lot of the younger generation is, I suppose, an understanding that redlining at all times isn't the best way for efficiency. So I do hope we'll start to see people having a better relationship with whether their own time meditating, their own time doing nothing, their own time doing all these things that that were probably quite an important part of society and family life X amount of 100 years ago that has completely been sort of wiped out now. And I actually want to share with you sort of an experience that I had when I first came to Korea, because I think this will be quite interesting for you as well. Korea is just maybe the worst place on earth to sleep. It really completely is. The place I live in, for example, the buildings are built very fast. It's a very modern country. Industry happens so quickly. Quite often means that the soundproofing isn't so good. The apartments are very noisy. Not only that, there's just bright lights in the streets everywhere. Like, that's the way they advertise here, like neon lights everywhere. You can do anything at any hour of the day or night here. I can go get food at 4 a.m. It's just always, nothing ever sleeps. People tend to, their jobs tend to be later and things like that. Construction's always occurring. And for me, the first year or so of me living here, getting used to working late too, because I start work at 1 p.m., it was really bad. I had a really, really hard time getting used to it. And now I feel like I'm starting to get there. And maybe when I return to Australia, it might be weird to try and flip back. But yeah. With that in mind, what for you are the biggest roadblocks that you see in terms of people and sleep?
Yeah, so valuing sleep is one. So right. There's different subpopulations within the roadblocks, but the biggest one, and this is why we get all this messaging out about you need 8 hours of sleep, is society-wide people don't prioritize sleep. Sleep is the thing to put in the corner that you finally give into when you can't get away with not giving into it anymore. You know, you will, in some respects, we're all guilty of it. We'll run on as much voluntary sleep deprivation as we can carry until performance starts to drop. Mm-hmm. You know, we're all constantly testing, you know, where we sit on that. So it's respect for sleep, recognizing sleep isn't something that we can trade off, push to the corner. It's got to be given equal priority to nutrition and exercise. You know, often the paradox is people will set the alarm to get up at 5 a.m. to go and exercise. So they'll lose 2 hours of sleep to put the exercise in there, not recognizing that, in fact, if you slept in a bit longer, you might actually feel a whole lot better and you may train better and you may get more out of your exercise. You know, it's trying to just make sure all those things are in balance. So that's one group of recognizing you need to prioritize sleep. And then there's a separate group. They're the group that often I'm more seeing, or people who feel like sleep's not working for them. They almost get the total opposite. They prioritize sleep too highly. It's almost becomes this elusive thing that if only I could get more, you know, I would feel better and my life would be better. They're almost trying too hard for sleep, thinking about it too much, trying too hard for it. And so it's a polar opposite approach. You've got some people who, you know, trying to push it to the corner, and some people who are prioritizing it too much. So for me, they're the two barriers. And then for some respects, for people thinking, which camp am I in? and a healthy way is to sort of sit somewhere in the middle, have a healthy sort of respect for sleep and recognize, like, I can't push it to the side. I need to set aside space for it. But as long as I set aside space, if I'm in good physical and mental health, yeah, whatever happens in that space happens. I just trust my body will self-regulate. It'll take the sleep it needs. It'll be different. Some nights longer, some nights shorter, some nights lighter, some nights deeper, but it'll self-regulate. I don't micromanage my blood pressure. I don't micromanage other aspects of health. I don't need to micromanage my sleep either. Mm-hmm. I just need to create the right opportunity and let that be. So just trying to sort of be in that sort of happy medium in between. You can almost think of it in a commercial sense. You know, one group, sleep is the commodity. It's the thing, I take it or leave it, not so fussed about it. Another group, the sleep's the luxury item. It's the must have luxury handbag that I just am always wishing I could have. And so when I'm listening to people talk about sleep, and a lot of what I do when I work with people is just listen to them, if sleep's the luxury item that they really want, there's a problem. They're wanting it too bad. And once we start to want sleep too bad, we start to overthink it and try too hard, and it becomes too big a thing. So that's, for me, they're the two barriers, the trying too hard or not respecting sleep enough and trying to find a happy sort of medium in the middle. And not thinking about it automatically. You know, I have these really lovely cultural experiences. I do a lot of work in India. Right. And in a generational sense, the older generation, like my parents' age, that generation in India, we, you know, they'll still have a common practice of yoga. The practice of meditation will be part of their day-to-day life. But the younger generation, say people in their 30s and 40s who are very westernized, would see themselves modern Indians, have dropped all that meditation practice and have sleep problems. You know, I got a domestic flight in India last time I was there last year. And, you know, sat next to a lovely older lady who was going back to visit her family. And, you know, she asked me what I did. I said, I'm going to a sleep conference to teach people about insomnia. She's like, well, why do you need to worry about that for? Sleep's not a problem. Because she just had a meditation and a yoga practice. You know, and Korea's a nice example too. So, yeah, everyone's starting work later than neon lights. But what you don't, you know, what people often don't see is the 8 o'clock in the morning, people in the parks doing, you know, gentle movement-based
stuff like that.
Exercises. But that's a different generation. Mm-hmm. You've got the generation that's often sleeping okay and not caught up in the neon lights and the fastness, who's still doing their traditional sort of slow movement exercises in the morning. And the generation who's moved beyond that's caught up in that sort of faster work pace and having that difficulties.
You've hit me quite hard there, David, in all honesty, because I'm definitely of the group where I want the sleep and I just can't seem to get it. I'm definitely falling into that category. So we get into the sort of the last minute or two. I like to ask, I guess, all of the academics or scientists that I speak to, the same kind of question, which is sort of like the magic wand question, right? Which is, knowing what you know, knowing sort of the cultural pressures that are occurring, what would you like to see changed, be it on any level you can choose, sort of on a personal level with each individual, on a healthcare level, or even on a governmental level? What would you like to see sort of change that would really differ and make a difference to our relationship with sleep and the prognosis of the future generations?
Yeah, I think respect for rest, and almost seeing rest and sleep as something that we need as humans and that we need to allocate time for that. And that it's not as if I must have X amount of hours of rest and X amount of hours of sleep, but just there's got to be time off. And that time off could be resting, could be sleeping, and our body will work out what it needs in that space. So rather than focusing on I need this much sleep and it has to occur under these circumstances, yeah, just as a broader society, having an understanding that as human beings, we need rest. And that rest can be awake, not sleeping, or sleeping, you know, or just time off, but rest.
Great. All right, David. So if people are interested in what you had to say and they sort of want to learn a little bit more, where is the best place to go?
Yeah, so I run a podcast as well called Sleep Talk. Talking all things sleep, that's on all the usual podcast distribution channels. I run a website about sleep called Sleep Hub, so that's sleephub.com. sleep.com.au. So they're the best places to go to look for information about sleep or to learn more about sleep. You know, those in my professional capacity, I work as a specialist sleep physician at a clinic in Melbourne, and people who want to see me there, that's at drdavidcunnington.com.au.
Fantastic. Well, I'll definitely put all that information down in the notes as well for people to look for. Again, David, thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it.
No worries. Pleasure.
If you enjoyed what you listened to or have any feedback, or if you just want to say hello, please help out by visiting the Blunt Report on social media, giving a rating, or even telling a friend about what you listened to. The podcast is available on all platforms, including video podcasts on YouTube, or can be found at thebluntreport.com.